So I'm Adam Serwer with the American Prospect, and I'm here with
Michael Moynihan. Yeah, I can introduce myself if you'd like.
That's
right. Yeah, Michael Moynihan, senior editor at Reason, Reason Magazine, and at Reason TV.
And we're here to, I guess, talk about the pretty pretty big events of this week, from the shooting in Tucson to the rather feverish response to it. And you wrote a post about it a couple of days ago that you expressed some pretty strong feelings about what happened.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I have to say that I am often accused of being, I think, too mild, and I think that was probably on display in our last Blogging Heads, where I think we agreed on everything and bored everyone to tears. I suspect that's probably not going to happen now, because this one really, the response to this, I think, has been really, really disgusting. And I think that's not even strong enough of a word. I was really, really appalled by it. And the political opportunism and how everyone jumped into the scrum within, almost seemed like within minutes, on Twitter to start finger pointing and saying somebody is responsible. And I mean, the whole thing drove me a bit mad and made me want to retire from writing about politics and, write travel pieces for, like the Mormon magazine or something.
I bet that's an awesome job. I'm just going to let you know right now. it's an awesome job.
Yeah,
Mormons travel a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
they
goodness.
Go to a lot of cool places.
All within the state of Idaho, but, you know. objecting to, and I think it's not going to surprise anyone. It was what I think a lot of people objected to, and as the sort of story played out, I think it was a kind of a bipartisan thing. After a while, there was I saw a lot of people, John Chait even saying, and people at Mother Jones saying, that okay, if you want to have a conversation about the national tone and the tone of the debate, and this is actually something that I've written quite a bit about, and I've written quite a bit about my objections to not necessarily the tone, but just the stupidity of things coming out of the mouths of Glenn Beck and these sort of knuckle draggers like Mark Levin and Michael Savage and just the usual crowd. That's fine, but there's obviously not a coincidence that we're having this conversation in the wake of the shooting, and many people were very explicit about tying the shooting to the rhetoric on right-wing radio and right-wing television. And, evidence be damned, that was what provoked this. It turns out that's not what provoked this, and I just wish that everyone had waited a little bit. And, I'm perfectly willing to have this conversation, as I think a lot of people are, about the tone in American politics, and whether, this is a unique thing in American history, this is a particular time, that this is particularly hot right now, more so than when billboards were going up the side of the road saying impeach Earl Warren. I mean, is there something different about it now? I mean, that's actually an interesting debate. I was rather surprised, though, that the immediate response was very, very partisan, very, very much directed at Beck, Limbaugh, et cetera, and not actually, a conversation, for instance, about gun laws, about mental health. And there has been a few of those now. They're kind of trickling out. I think that's the sort of better conversation to have.
Yeah, I mean, so I wrote a couple things immediately after. I mean, the first thing I said was that we're at a time when political violence has actually never been less legitimate in American history. Hmm. I mean, I think, American history has been pretty violent, especially when it comes to politics. I mean, we did fight a civil war. There was a period in the South when, you talk about regulatory capture, like the police, the authorities were mostly in the hands of people who are not going to prosecute people for crimes committed against Black people. I mean, part of what I wrote was that there's the one thing to be optimistic about the sort of partisan bickering immediately after the shooting was the fact that neither side actually really wants to be seen as endorsing violence. That became clear. As much as some of the rhetoric on the right bothers me, and I think I would probably be harsher about it than than you would. I think that, you know, it is important, it's significant that neither side really wants to be blamed for this and was so desperate not to be blamed for it that they were going at each other over it. I mean, it's not, you know, I think, you know, the part of my mind was a little bit on Pakistan because the governor of Punjab had been killed for speaking out against those anti-blasphemy laws, and that's
by one of his own bodyguards,
by one of his own bodyguards, and what had happened there was that people were actually saying this guy deserves to die, someone kill him, as opposed to being like, you know, I think Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City, he said, you know, these people sometimes leave you with the impression that violence is acceptable, and I think that's actually fair, a fair description of some of what gets said on talk radio is that it's not so much that it says you should go out and commit violence, but at a certain point when you get led to believe that your opponents are trying to destroy the country, they're trying to impose Sharia law, they're trying to, you know, do all these terrible things. I mean, I think the fact that we actually haven't had more violence is indicative of how seriously people actually really don't take that stuff. But at a certain point, it's like, what are you going to do? I mean, if you really think that the president is secretly working with Al-Qaeda, I mean, what are you going to do at a certain point? And there's nothing, I mean, you know, some, you know, anyway, I've made my point.
Yeah, no, a couple of things is that, first of all, I mean, it's, we get off and have this discussion, which was, you know, started for reasons that are completely baffling to me. Why not have had this conversation 3 weeks prior to the shooting, because it's unrelated to the shooting? I mean, we know that for a fact. I mean, that's what really bothers me, is that, okay, we have to have this national conversation about motives that this guy didn't have. Okay, well, fine. Let's have the conversation anyway. What I wrote about this yesterday, actually, one of these long, tedious pieces that I tend to put on the blog that I don't, I imagine nobody reads, because, you know, it's like,
I read them. I linked to something you put in that piece. Jesse Walker's response to David.
Oh yeah.
That was actually very.
Yeah. Jesse's a really amazingly smart guy. And it was a really, really interesting piece and something. But I wrote one yesterday that, you know, it was one of these sort of blog post ambient things that just puts people to sleep about, you know, what is this, a bidirectional thing? Just by the very logic of it, it can't be a unidirectional thing. So, and what I mean by that is, if this rhetoric is so hot that it is going to inspire people to be a bit, you know, to take actions and say, you know, look, Glenn Beck is right. These people are destroying our country, and it is up to me, the mentally disturbed person, to save it. Now, if that is the case, does the counter rhetoric, for lack of a better phrase, is that, can that itself also not be dangerous? Now, and the example that I used was Lee Harvey Oswald. And what Oswald did in, I guess it was about 5 months prior to the assassination of President Kennedy, was he took two shots at, or I think maybe one shot at General Edwin Walker, who was the head at the time, one of the heads of the Birch Society, and a real, real nutter. I mean, a real fluoride in the water, said that the Kennedy administration was a gang of criminals and the rest of it. He had been reading this stuff in The Militant, which was one of the Communist Party papers at the time, he photographed himself with the gun, the famous Mannlicher Carcano, and the copy of The Militant, that famous picture in the backyard, and said, you know, look, this guy is nuts, and he's going to bring fascism to America. So what he had actually told his wife, Myrna, that, you know, if I kill General Walker, it would be like killing Hitler. And I'm going to save people's lives. So I think that when you heap so much blame on the right, and I'll give you an example of this. And again, I hate to always preface the fact that I'm a big, I bad at nobody. You know, I hate Glenn Beck, and I have written enough about this to prove that. I saw David Brock on Hardball, I think it was yesterday, the day before. I'm talking to Chris Matthews. He didn't challenge him on this, and this is the exact phrasing. He said, Glenn Beck has been responsible. That was the word, no qualifications, been responsible for three previous assassination attempts. I mean, this is madness. I mean, really, Glenn Beck is responsible. So if I say that I think that X policy is incredibly dangerous for America, and somebody goes out and shoots the person that is trying to push that policy through, I, by this logic, am therefore responsible. And I think that we have to have a a smarter conversation, because, I mean, we've had a similar conversations about video games, for instance. People play violent video games, and therefore they are responsible. We've had them about heavy metal music. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the evidence that somebody is, you know, should be responsible for, like, some madman taking or planning an assassination attempt against somebody because they were a fan of Glenn Beck? I mean, this is really tenuous. It seems like...
I think
it just seems like
Beck... With Beck, it gets a little less tenuous than with just about everyone else, and I wouldn't have used what David Brock said. I would have, no. The more accurate phrase is that several crazy people have said they were violent because of Glenn Beck, which is not the same thing as Glenn Beck being responsible.
Okay.
But that did happen. I mean, there are these people. I forget their names, but there's two people that at least. Media Matters has posted sort of transcripts of interviews with these people. There's like where they said something like, well, Beck is the only one who understands what's going on, what goes on, and yada, yada, yada. And I think what's interesting about Beck is, again, like, we talked about Beck's sort of like persona as something that's not really real. And it's sort of like whenever something like this happens, Beck sort of pulls back in a way that's sort of very conscious. Like, I think the day after Monday's show was fascinating. Because he put Martin Luther King, a quote from Martin Luther King about nonviolence on the screen. You know what I mean? Which on some level is like, can't be bad. I mean, it's disingenuous. But it can't ultimately be, on some level that's really a good thing.
Sure,
But I think that, I think that with Beck, some of the things, there's something about Beck's like, way of connecting a lot of different things that does appeal to some crazy people. Although I wouldn't say that he's necessarily responsible in the I think that goes too far.
So what I guess the question is what happens when somebody who's a big fan of I'm not going to name it because I don't think it's fair, but if you're so I'll just say generically sort of lefty blog. Who says that, and I mean, I've seen this a million times, of people saying that, you know, Fox and Beck and these guys are, and using this phraseology too, that a threat to democracy, and this is a threat to the American, you know, we should, you know, have laws against this hate speech, et cetera. Somebody says that, you know, that's absolutely true. Some crazy person says, and I think this is really dangerous and I worry for my country and I'm going to go shoot Glenn Beck. I mean, who's therefore responsible? I think the guy who's crazy and shoots Glenn Beck, I don't think the lefty blog should have any... Mm-hmm. For pointing this stuff. The point is, I think you get into a really, really kind of creepy gray area when people are trying to look for silver bullet kind of explanations for things. And I guess this is a good time to transition to last night. And I think President Obama did an absolutely brilliant job. I mean, I was Boehner-like watching Matt last night. I think he was really fantastic. It was like, you know, I was choking up a little bit, and I thought that in that bit, and I knew that there was going to be a rush from everybody on every side to say, he is, you know, validating my political opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a great rebuke to everyone in this debate, and it was a very presidential, very clever, very calm way of saying, you all please shut the hell up. And I was like, you know what? Thank you. And it's like, I don't want to hop on Twitter or write a blog post and say, you know, Obama's saying to the left, stop blaming the right. I just, if that might be the case, I think that's part of it. I think that this rancorous, this bickering, which gets nobody anywhere and everyone's just trying to score points for their side. And I think he struck a really fantastic tone last night, and this is the first bipartisan moment of the week that everyone that I talked to, and I only looked today, I didn't look last night, I looked today, and I realized that everybody from, you know, like Charles Krauthammer, I saw on this clip on YouTube, was like, what a brilliant speech. Everybody seemed to think this was fantastic. I mean, what was your impression of it?
When he came on, I was sort of sitting on a couch at the Y across the street from our office, and it was sort of incredible. There were, but I looked around, and in the middle of the speech, there were like 30 people there around me watching it.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really good speech. I think President Obama is really good at two things. Which I think are actually subjects of irritation to the left. One of them is that he's, the part that's irritating, I think, is that he's always at his best when he's telling both sides to chill.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely
and,
right.
And he's just very good at that. Like, as a rhetorical, sort of as a rhetorical mode, he's very good at saying, this is what's wrong with the right, this is what's wrong with the left, and this is why I'm right. He's just very good at it. And the second thing he's good at is he's never more inspiring as when he talks about America and sort of his optimism for the country. And I think that that's, I mean, and what I was thinking about while I was watching that speech last night is I sort of find it mystifying that conservatives talk so often about him as though he doesn't, when it's sort of like that's actually the thing that he does best is talk in abstractions about why America is great and why it's going to get better.
You know, I saw this actually on, to be hugely nerdy and say, I saw this on your Twitter feed. it still seems awkward for me to say that. I did, and I thought, I really agreed with it, was that kind of sentiment, is that I am also mystified how the real sort of extremists and this extreme Obama haters. I mean, look, you and I could talk and be at each other's throat about Obama's policies, and I, you know, disagree with a whole pile of them, and I would say most certainly a majority of them. I don't understand, as I don't think you do, and as you express this on Twitter, where these things come from, where these kind of real wacky ideas about Obama. And I'll tell you what, I saw at the bookstore when I was home for Christmas, this book by somebody I'd never heard of, I writes for one of these goofy WorldNet Daily type websites, called The Manchurian President. And I thought this was a really revealing title, this is what happens. We have no evidence that the guy is a, you know, Kenyan Marxist Bukharin supporter, or whatever the hell people say he is. So therefore, it must be subterranean. It must be a Manchurian. He's a sleeper agent. And I find this so baffling that there are people out there. And in fairness, I think they're a very, very small, but very, very vocal group that would watch that speech last night and say that he is deceiving us. He loathes this country. He's quoting, scripture. And it's like, you know, I know he's really, secretly he's wishing he could quote the Quran or something. This kind of madness, which I think, oftentimes gets amplified. I think that there's too much attention for political reasons paid to birthers and these types. But they do exist. And I don't think they're repudiated with enough vigor by people that, have a huge audience, whether they be Mark Levin or these types. I do find this really fascinating. I mean, you have to use the sort of lefty academic language, you really have to otherize the president to make him a hate figure. And it's, look, I mean,
and I gotta tell you, conservative conspiracy theorists of the president have forgotten more about like obscure socialist college professors than I will ever know. I don't even know who half these people are.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know who Cloward Piven were before Beck started talking about that. I had no idea who these people were.
Yeah, well, you're obviously lying because you're a sleeper communist agent.
I'm secretly
trying to deceive us all.
Right.
But, you know, I think that the greatest, smartest piece about this is a guy who I have an enormous amount of respect for, a conservative writer named Andy Ferguson, you may or may not know, who is at the Weekly Standard, reviewed Dinesh D'Souza's
ridiculous book. That was a good review.
It was great. And look, I mean, he said it in, because Andy's a very funny writer, he said it in 1,000 words. He could have probably said it in a sentence if somebody was holding a gun to his head and said, you know, condense this. But his point was this, you know, Obama's not a Kenyan. He's not a Fanonist. He's a liberal. And, for somebody, you know, in 2007, 2008 to say that would you imagine that the hardest attacks against Obama on foreign policy is on the tax compromise would be from the left? I mean, people would be like, well, no. I mean, the left is, you know, secretly, you know, controlling him with puppet strings. I mean, it's interesting. But anyway, that's, I suppose, off subject. Speech last night, I thought just hit a lot of great tones. And again, I'm absolutely amazed that the ability that he had to really – unite the pundit class, who this loathsome group of, you know, idiots who have just been clawing at each other. And, you know, I suppose I've been unfortunately involved in that too,
I think what I really regret is I didn't, you know, I was very clear in my writing. I was like, you know, this didn't happen because of, you know, the Tea Partiers want lower taxes or because of the Affordable Care Act. But yeah. I actually somewhat regret not defending Palin earlier, because it was, I mean, the whole target map thing, even though I thought that was like, I thought the target map originally was a terrible and ugly idea. I think it was not appropriate to blame her for Jared Loughner. And I sort of wish I had spoken up about that sooner rather than, I mean, I said something about it, but I was, at the time it was in the context of explaining why blood libel was a really stupid way to describe how she had been wronged. But I do wish that I had said something earlier.
I think that I hope this is the last time I defend Sarah Palin. I think that she is a really embarrassing figure and a really pathetic figure, and I really wish she'd just exit the stage and just go to Bravo or TLC or wherever her television show is. But I would say that
she got canceled.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's what I heard. I saw it on Twitter, though, so it might not be true. You got to be careful when you Twitter source things.
Yeah, well, we've learned that in the past week. Oh, well, that's, you know, too bad, because I was hoping that the reality television would prevent her from being a political force in America, but apparently that's not going to happen. I think yesterday might have done that. I'm going to vigorously defend Palin on a couple of these things, and one is that we've learned about Sarah Palin and the people who work for her is that they're very literal, right? So they're targeting districts. They put, you know, targets, gun sites, whatever they are. Blood libel. I was amazed that, and again, people are just trying to score political points. They're not trying to get to the root of this. Why Sarah Palin said X? Clearly, she had no idea what this was. Right, she had no idea that the background of this. So there's blood involved. People, this is a bloody affair that she's been accused of having blood on her hands, and she feels she's been libeled. So together we have a blood libel. Right. I mean, she's clearly not thinking of, you know, Mendel Bellis and the, you know, the Russian turn of the century blood libels. I think that it was another really embarrassing moment, two in a row. First, with blaming the Tea Party for this awful event in Arizona, and second of all, like, okay, maybe we can deliver another, not necessarily a knockout blow, but we can really wound Sarah Palin by, you know, saying that she's, I mean, it just, it's stupid. I saw another, I mean, imagine how many references to Twitter we're using today. I also saw on Twitter that Nate Silver, who is an amazingly smart guy, who, you know, is, you know, doing these, I had no idea what a blood libel was. And I was like, oh, interesting. I mean, because this was something that when I was in college, I was, did a lot on modern European history and Russian history. So this stuff came up. So, I mean, I was, you know, nerdy enough to be interested in those subjects. And I was, I guess not surprised, but I was interested to find out that, you know, like really, really smart people didn't know what the background of this. And
yeah,
you know, it's a whole lot of nothing.
I was actually pretty viscerally offended by it. And I think, you know, my upbringing, you know, I'm Jewish, and I remember as a kid learning about blood libel at a very young age, because, I mean, like, you know, the Golem of Prague is actually about blood libel. You know, the Golem is there to protect the Jews from accusations of blood libel. So I learned about this stuff really early, and it was actually pretty formative for me, because I spent a lot of my early life in Catholic countries, where occasionally someone would accuse me of killing Jesus, and, you know, kids fight, whatever. But it was
can you tell me what country was the worst?
I was in Italy.
Okay. Yes,
I was
in
Italy. Yeah. You know, we're talking really young, like 6, 7 years old. Like kids, you know, they know that they're going to mass, and then for some reason I didn't get a first communion, and I'm weird, and I don't, you know, no. It's just one of those things. So, you know, but it was very much a, like, you know, I was very angry when I first read that in the morning, and it wasn't, it really wasn't just, you know, let's destroy. And I think a lot of people were, I mean, it, just to look, I mean, not to fuel any conspiracy theories, but you know, Jews are pretty well represented among political reporters. And I think there was like, there was pretty much, I think there was a similar sort of horror around, around everybody, but I think everybody did actually assume that she knew what she was saying. And she, I think you're probably right that she didn't. But
yeah,
but
well, I mean, this was, is the weird thing about
Palin. It's just a term that like, I mean, I associate that term with like being, you know, forced to sit down and watch Schindler's List in Hebrew school when I was 11. You know what I mean? Like I associate it with like, you know, this like yeah. really, really awful stuff.
Yeah, well, at least they didn't make you watch. Really they didn't make you watch the, you know, the Sorrow and the Pity or something like 9 hours. So at least you got the abridged Schindler's List. No, right. The amazing thing about this is that everybody. I think you're right. Everyone did assume she knew what she was talking about and what she was referencing. But I mean, everyone really has to stop there for a second and say, look, you cannot have it both ways. She is either a moron or she is somebody who understands, you know, 19th century czarist anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. I mean, right. It's she doesn't like I don't read which papers do you read? All of them. Oh, but by the way, yeah. Let me tell you about the history of anti-Semitism and blood libels and making matzahs from Jewish
Fair
blood.
Enough.
I mean, I just don't think you can have it both ways. The Palin, the other thing is like, it's amazing being in this position of defending Palin so much this week when I've said so many nasty things about her. I think it was Jonathan Martin. I don't want to blame Jonathan Martin. Maybe somebody else. Was either yesterday or this morning, writing that, you know, Sarah Palin inserted herself into the story. Come on. I mean, look, what would happen if somebody said, you know, there was a mass shooting in DC and it was and it was clearly influenced by Adam Serwer? I mean, I would really hope that you would go out there and defend yourself. I mean,
sure.
She do it the right way? I mean, was she, you know, in that stupid Palin way that one has come to expect from her? Perhaps, but I mean, let the woman defend herself mm-hmm. against this charge that she is somehow, you know, complicit in a mass or a huge six people being murdered.
I would say that the day that the victims were being memorialized was definitely not the day to do it.
Yeah, well,
I mean, if she
yeah.
had waited a day later and been like, yeah. and released this video, it probably, I mean, like, there might be the whole tale of two speeches thing, but I think if she had waited a little while longer before being like, oh, by the way, you guys are really wrong, I'm not sure that it would have had the same impact.
Do you get the impression, and I mean, I think it's pretty well established, and I mean, there are still people that are going to push this. I, you know, Matthews being one of them, Paul Krugman's column. I'm just waiting for Frank Rich's column, which will be something. I mean, can we all agree now that if we want to have a conversation about the dialogue in this country, which again is fine, it's curious timing if it has nothing to do with the shooting in Arizona. But can we all agree that this, what we know now, which is quite a bit, Jared Loughner, however you pronounce his name, was not a Tea Partier, was not motivated by talk radio, was not motivated by Fox News.
He might have been motivated by some like really, 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 really fringe ideas. Like there's something, I think Eugene Volokh had a sort of interesting post, or at least it was at the about like how he was ranting about the first constitution, which probably meant like article. I mean, but we're talking like really fringe, not like, not even really, he's not talking about the individual mandate for certain,
yeah.
Or taxes being too high. Yeah. He's sort of on a different planet, even if like, there's a kind of like right wing anti-government tinge to it. I mean, like it really is like in a different galaxy.
I mean, it is, from what I can tell, is that we might as well blame, you know, Gore Vidal. And why would we blame Gore Vidal? Well, Gore Vidal is a truther, and so is this guy. And, you know, I'll tell you what, it's time to bring down the government if they're behind the murder of 3,000 of our fellow citizens. I mean, if they actually did this, let's start wiping out representatives who are part of this machine. I mean, I just, it gets
into this
territory.
I'm always shocked
it's so strange.
I'm always shocked at the number of people who are truthers. And it's people I sort of don't expect to be. I mean, have you ever bumped into a truther who you didn't know was a truther, someone who you've known for like a decent amount of time who like suddenly like just casually suggests, oh, by the way, the government, you know, 9/11.
Yes. It happened to me recently with somebody who it was actually really depressing that this person who's I've known for a very, very long time, was a truther. And it happens to me, you know, most frequently, when I'm in New York, when I used to live there too, when I was at dinner parties, I used to get, there's something weird about the conspiratorial mind, is that there is this joy that people have of dropping this bombshell at the dinner mm-hmm. table and saying, I know something that you don't know. Right. And you guys are all sheep, and that you see this sort of, you know, this flicker in their eyes and saying, like, geez, I'm going to blow your mind right now. And I have actually mm-hmm. done my research. And yeah, I am always shocked at how common it is. It's actually interesting tying it back to this. I saw Mark Potok, on MSNBC, mm-hmm. A couple days ago. And he had this really amazing, he's somebody that's really been trying to shoehorn all of this guy's beliefs into, you know, the kind of extreme far right narrative, which, you know, is getting more implausible. But he said, you know, America's an interesting place. We're a conspiratorial country. Okay, I agree with that. And he said, you know, look, this is something that Europeans don't do. They don't have this kind of culture. And I was planning on writing or blogging about this. And as somebody who lived there for many years and worked in politics there also, this simply isn't true. And I thought the 9/11 truther stuff, I was shocked at how common it was amongst the sort of intelligentsia in, you know, Stockholm, Berlin, London.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Not, I mean, look, it's the number, a best-selling book in France was Thierry Meyssan's book about 9/11 conspiracy. I mean, it was a bestseller for months. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, television play, TV4 and Sweden Plays Loose Change.
I one of my favorite sort of YouTube videos, old school YouTube videos, is when Bill Clinton gets asked a truther question, and he gets the lip, and he's just like, "How dare you?" He just gets this look on his face, and he starts wagging the finger, and it's sort of class. I mean, like I don't know, I sort of
was the question, did you know about America being behind 9/11 when you were selling
about, like,
cocaine at Maine Airport?
Or, yes. It was some sort of Building 7 question, but it was sort of the classic Clinton indignation.
Yeah.
You know, at a sort of very, very, it was such a forceful response to what had been asked, a ridiculous question that had been asked very casually.
I wish everyone
responded.
I
want to pivot to something that I hope we'll disagree on.
Okay, great.
Which is, high capacity ammo clips.
Sure.
And just gun control as a response to this stuff in general. I'm not the world's biggest gun control guy. I just am not. I just don't think. I mean, like, the sort of empirical evidence suggests that there's not actually that much reducing the amount of guns would really do to stop violent crime.
Yeah.
But I don't understand. You know, but if we banned high capacity ammo clips, I certainly would not be really upset about it. I just sort of don't understand. You know, my position is I don't really know why you would want a 30 round extended ammo clip, because, you know, if you're in a situation where you need a 30-round extended ammo clip, you're probably already screwed. I mean, chances. I mean, like, how many? I mean, unless you're Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando, you're probably already done.
Yeah. You know, let me preface this by saying I don't write about gun control issues. I mean, as a magazine, we do quite a bit, and we have guys like Brian Doherty who wrote a book for Cato on the DC gun case. The high capacity, this is, you know, interestingly, a argument that I wish that was the immediate argument that we'd have, because I think it's an interesting one. First thing, I found it amazing, by the way, that the New York Post, I guess it was yesterday, and nobody picked up on this. I saw it in the print edition. I don't know where it was lying around. And the New York Post actually had, I mean, conservative editorial page had a editorial saying that Glocks should be banned in general. I mean, I was completely stunned by this. They said, look, you know, handguns aren't used for hunting, so why do we need them anyway? So, I mean, that was surprising to me. But look, what I find interesting about it is, you know, would a high-capacity, low-capacity clip, I mean, he was tackled when he was reloading, would a lower-capacity clip have meant fewer casualties? You know, next to impossible to say unless you have a video seeing how this all played out. It's not clear to me that if, you know, these things were more difficult to obtain, that they wouldn't have been obtained anyway. And I mean, that's generally how I feel about gun control. I've, again, lived in countries where there's an enormous number of weapons per capita. Sweden's one of them, has a huge number of weapons because of a very, you know, big hunting culture. Switzerland has a semi-automatic weapon in every house where there's somebody who served in the army, that people keep their weapons at home. Israel, et cetera. You know, Michael Moore is tweeting about this yesterday, I saw, but, he says it's not guns, it's fear. You know, there's just as many guns in Canada, et cetera. There is something unique about a culturally unique thing about America. And I don't know what that is because I don't want to, be one of those jackass people who just fires off, and excuse the metaphor, half cocked, because I don't write about this, I don't think about it too much, but the one thing that I've been thinking about is that if you had these high capacity clips, if you had these types of guns, et cetera, in the city where I used to live, Stockholm, and if you just left them in the middle of the big square in Stockholm loaded with these high capacity clips, and there were 100 guns, and you would have 100 people returning them to the police. I mean, it's just what you would see in Sweden is that it is this very, very strange, uniquely American thing that I think that if you banned, you banned handguns in D.C. and it hasn't done much to stop the enormous sort of epidemic of violence, gang related violence here, drug related violence. Right. So yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't, to be totally honest and to be totally fair, I haven't given it tons of thought because most of the debate that we've had about this has been about something so kind of different and strange that, I don't know. What's your take on that?
Well, I grew up mostly in DC, so, I'm pretty disillusioned about gun control because DC is next to the, biggest, gun market in the country. So it's, there's actually no way to, like, the DC handgun ban was useless. And I actually don't think there's anything particularly offensive about people having a handgun at home to protect their home with. But in general, I think what's interesting is that.
So can we put the headline on this Blogging Heads that Adam Serwer, big fan of the Second Amendment, loves guns? Is that okay?
I mean, you know, I don't love guns. I mean, but I just think that, it actually doesn't really sound all that unreasonable. I mean, like, what's interesting is, like, I think liberals are very comfortable saying, hey, let's look at the Constitution in light of, like, the social and technological advances of the last 200 years whenever we're talking about any other amendment. So, like, Eighth Amendment, I think Clarence Thomas says, punishment only refers to a sentence meted out by a judge, not conditions to conditions of confinement. I think that's ridiculous. But, it's hard for me to say I think that's ridiculous. But, 200 years later, we don't have militias anymore. So obviously people shouldn't be able to have guns. I mean, no, I think that's a little silly.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of guns. I don't think that all gun regulations are silly. I think that some are probably pretty reasonable, and even Scalia said that. But I think what's interesting is that the distinct lack of panic in response to this is something I find fascinating. Like, often, there are some really stupid ideas out there, like the Comprehensive Protect Peter King Act of 2011.
Yes, yes. I think that I read this on Twitter, and again, the 50th reference to Twitter, is that Peter King has long believed that the only people that deserve to have guns are the Irish Republican Army and the police.
Right. Right. I mean, like, there's a lot of, but in general, I think the backlash, the sort of panic instinct has been not actually that bad with the Loeffner attack in comparison to other things. I think, what gun owners need to
Why do you think that is? I mean, I have a theory on this, but why do you think that is?
I'm about to say it. I think what gun owners need to worry about is when somebody with an Arabic name pulls out a gun and slaughters a whole bunch of people in a mall, or something like that. Because the panic instinct is triggered not when crimes are committed by people we consider to be, like, we sort of recognize, but mm-hmm. but when it's committed by an other we've learned to fear, I think that panic instinct is much worse. I mean, this is how we ended up with the TSA body scanners, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that, you know, when it's Jared Loughner, it's easy to be like, well, you can't stop crazy people. But if it's another Nidal Malik Hassan, you know, I think that's when things are going. I mean, the response, I think, the political pressure to sort of do something, which is often a really bad idea in the wake of an incident, yeah. will be much yeah. stronger.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And what I found kind of amazing about this was the lack of a immediate response, which I think you saw, I mean, after the assassination attempt on President Reagan, Brady Bill, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think that there is now, you know, a wide kind of acceptance. And I think you're right to say that, well, he's just a crazy person. There's no way of preventing mm-hmm. it. I mean, if this was unique to America, for instance, I think maybe there would be a different feeling. I think that people do know that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, after the Dunblane massacre in Scotland, there was a ban on handguns in England, and there has been you know, these sort of mass shootings since. I mean, there have been school shootings in Finland, a couple of pretty vicious ones, a number of really, really terrible ones in Germany, where handguns are very, very restricted in both of those places. So I think I think that is the response, is that, you know, look, we can pass a whole bunch of laws, but you know, it's kind of an analog to the drug war, is that, you know, you can ban something, but if people, you know, it's a demand problem. If people want it, they're going to get it. And right. I do have that feeling about Loughner, and I think that the interesting debate is the clip thing. I haven't thought this through so much, but if you want to, I mean, the amazing thing is there wasn't this response despite the fact that he bought the gun legally. Mm-hmm. That typically you'd say, oh, well, he bought it, you know, in Juarez at like a drug market. You'd be like, well, of right. course, you know, of course, this is where he's getting it. But you know, he bought it legally, and there still hasn't been a huge debate about this. There is starting to be an interesting debate about mental health, and deinstitutionalization. And this comes up against a lot of libertarian stuff, Thomas Sowers and these people that argue for deinstitutionalization, and those that are now arguing against it. I mean, you see William Galston is doing this in the New Republic, and you know, Glenn Greenwald.
I thought that was really frightening. I thought Galston's article. I mean, when you think about the fact, like, he sort of says it, but you look back and the Supreme Court ruling that said you cannot involuntarily confine people who are dangerous, who are not dangerous, who do not pose a danger to themselves or anyone else. You cannot involuntarily confine those people. That was a 9-0. Ruling.
Yeah, that was not, it wasn't even close, yeah.
It was not a controversial ruling. And yeah. it's actually, I mean, and to me, like, I look at something like that and I say to myself, you know, what's the ratio of people who are going to be helped like this versus, you know, how often this is going to be abused? And I'm not sure. You know, I mean, like, the whole reason to have a dangerousness standard is to be able to say, you know, we're helping those people who need help and who want help, not those people who are functional and don't want help. That's their choice.
Yeah, no, I mean, you don't want a situation where people are being confined involuntarily based on what? I mean, what are we basing this on? Whose judgment are we basing this on? Are we basing this on concerns from doctors, families, et cetera? I mean, it's a real kind of difficult position to you know, just grab somebody off the street. And, you know, I don't want to make it sound like... Vladimir Bukowski and people in the Soviet Union are being tossed in mental institutions because of their political views. I mean, it's not that bad, you know, but it was very, very frightening. And you know, look, I do understand. Look, I do understand the concerns. That said, I do understand the concerns that you know, that there's crazy people just wandering the streets and they should be looked after. I mean, or somebody should you know, take this stuff into consideration because people can be dangerous. But, you know, look, I mean, to just grab people and toss them into very frightening stuff.
The worst part, actually, and I think, like I said, I already think that was pretty bad. The worst part was the argument that people who don't snitch on crazy people would then, you know, people with mental health problems would then be forced to, subject to legal sanction. That was his argument.
Yes.
So you're supposed, yeah. You know, if your kid is, you know, what teenager isn't acting, you know, acting out at some point? If you don't have your kid involuntarily committed the second he shows signs of mental illness, which I'm willing to bet most teenagers do, then, you know,
I've never met a teenager who I didn't think was mentally ill. So I mean, it's a
right.
It's a.
I mean, this would put the Klebolds.
Yeah, I mean, this would put, you know, Dylan Klebold's parents, you know, in the dock, defending themselves. How come you didn't see that your son was mentally ill and was going to wear a trench coat and shoot everybody at school? I mean, it's a dumb idea. I think that as a general rule of thumb is that any solutions that are suggested within maybe a week or 2 weeks of a tragedy should just be thrown out immediately, because usually they're governed by emotion, they're motivated by emotion, and people aren't thinking these things through. And I think that goes for the political response too, is that, you know, this kind of immediate blame, got to be a Tea Partier guy. You know, I think that I didn't actually write about this for, I think, 2 or 3 days after, maybe 3 days, maybe 2 days, because immediately, I mean, I was, you know, Twittering back and forth with people of, you know, what was the, you know, what kind of information is coming out. But I was, you know, kind of cool your jets. I mean, Paul Krugman response. I mean, it was, I hate to say this, but it sounded like, you know, he wanted desperately to score points and he was going to try, you know, even if it didn't turn out the way, I don't want to say the way he wanted. That's completely unfair. But to say the way that he expected, that's what I mean. But, you know, and I wrote about this the other day, this idea that we should tone down the rhetoric, and then using a word that was coined, as I pointed out on Hit and Run the other day on Reason's blog, that was coined to describe German anti-Semitism in the lead up to the Holocaust, which is this word eliminationism, which has to be struck from the American political lexicon. It is something that Daniel General Goldhagen created in 1996. Never been a reference to it before. He acknowledges in his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, that he created eliminationists and exterminationists to define these types of anti-Semitism. And the fact that twice in Paul Krugman's column he's saying that the rhetoric that we must cool down is Nazi-like, I mean, is this, I mean, are we kidding at this point? I mean, this is what's, so you said before, you know, my piece or my blog post was kind of angry and a little hot under the collar. This does kind of piss me off. I mean, you see this guy, who's this guy? It's Columbia University guy. I saw it on Mediaite website, who is being interviewed and said, we got to cool down the rhetoric, and then called Barack Obama a murderer. I mean, from the left, saying that he's the drone strikes in Pakistan and everything. It's like, I don't think people even realize the level of hypocrisy in the past week about this rhetoric stuff. So,
well, I've used the term eliminationism before, and I actually, that's part of why I found your response and Jesse Walker's response so interesting, because I hadn't seen anybody else grapple with the use of the term. I actually also was not aware of its context, the context of its use as a very specific, as, you know, Hitler's anti-Semitism, attempt to destroy the Jews. But the reason why it struck me as an appropriate term when I think of eliminationism, I think of the cover to Sean Hannity's book where I think the subtitle is defeating despotism, terrorism, and liberalism. Right. It's put in the context of like these things that you would eliminate presumably through the use of military force.
That Sean Hannity wants to eliminate liberalism through military force.
No, I'm talking about eliminationist rhetoric, or when I've used the term, I'm talking about this sort of way of talking about liberalism is something that sort of needs to be eradicated in some way. And I know that for the most part, you know, or not even for the most, that 99% of conservatives who talk like this don't actually mean it in the way that it feels like they mean it. Because if they did, then obviously things would be much worse than they are. But there is like sort of a way of talking, about liberalism among some conservatives that suggests that it's a problem, like a disease that needs to be eradicated, as opposed to like just this other legitimate political group that you disagree with. And that's, I mean, that's what upsets me, and that's how I've used the term in the past.
I mean, I think that there is, we have to say that there's a lot of this stuff on the left, too. I mean, I did, and if anybody wants to look this up or something, I did a long thing about all these people complaining about rhetoric, and this was about 4 or 5 months ago, about the rhetoric of taking the country back. And 2 minutes of Googling, and there were 40 books. I mean, it was an Ed Schultz book. He was complaining about this, and he had actually written it himself. It was the subtitle in a book by Katrina Vandenhoevel. I mean, it's like this kind of stuff. This is hardball, stupid politics. I mean, it's not just hardball politics. It's, you know, mindless, ridiculous, dumb politics. And this is the kind of language people use. But I think that if we're going to talk about language and about the sort of uses and misuses of language, we really have to define our terms. I mean, if eliminationism, I mean, that sounds... I mean, it sounds exactly, you know, how it was meant to sound, of the sort of eradication of a group, of an ideology, of a ethnic group that people think are poisoning the body politic, and that's obviously the way it was in Germany and the way it was used in Germany. I mean, I think that isn't there a sort of subtler or more precise term? And I know that the person who this David Newark, is that how you pronounce it? Who had this book, Eliminations, he knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, he was the first one to pluck this from, and he knew that he was using Nazi language that was previously associated with eliminationist anti-Semitism to describe conservatives. And it's like, look, I mean, there are so many dumb talk radio conservatives, which I think we give them so much more credit by talking about them so much, like Michael Savage. And look, they have big-ish audiences. Glenn Beck does, what, 2 million? I mean, his numbers are going down. I saw it considerably. In a nation of 320 million, and God knows how many of the people that actually watch that are being influenced by this stuff. I mean, is it that influential? I'm not entirely sure. I'd like to, you know, we do have Barack Obama as a president. So I mean, that means something. But, you know, I just think that we should be much more precise about this. And when we're talking about, you know, over-the-top rhetoric, then probably not using a word that was previously only associated with Nazi genocide might not be the best word to kind of counteract that. So Paul Krugman saying, you know, that this is, we really have to change the tone of the debate in America, especially from this eliminationist conservatives. It's like, you know, I mean, please. I mean, you just don't sound serious at that point. You sound like somebody who's trying to wound your opponent and, you know, score points. You're not trying to, and look, the debate is not going to change. I mean, the debate didn't change after 9/11. We had a moment of unity. I'm so happy that Barack Obama had such a sort of, you know, fantastic, I think really fantastic speech last night. And I think that a lot of people maybe will say, okay, you know, maybe we really should tone this down. This is a bit ridiculous. And it is ridiculous, period. I don't think it's provoking violence. I just think it's dumb. And I'll just repeat this over and over again. But I mean, this is just a fact of life. This is just politics. I mean, the stuff that was being said about FDR, about, I mean, even Eisenhower, accusing him of being a communist, et cetera. I mean, it's a constant in American politics. And we should.
Yeah, I mean, you guys did a pretty funny video about the outrages that Thomas Jefferson was going to perform upon the men of the United States.
all true, by the way. What we didn't tell you is we actually agreed with everything in that video.
But no, I mean, I see your. I mean, that was why that Walker piece actually really made me think. I do think that, you know, like I said, I've used the term before, and I've used it, perhaps ignorant of its origin. But I mean, there is something. I do think there's a way about talk, and this I think may even just be a factor of the nature of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party's electoral coalition. The Democrats if not liberals, Democrats have to talk in a very different way, because they have moderates form a much bigger portion of their party than liberals do. And conservatives form a bigger portion of the Republican Party than liberals form of the Democratic Party. And as a result, there's a way in which Republicans can be a lot more strident that Democrats can't. And I think that, I mean, I think the sort of discussion of liberalism is something that needs to be destroyed. Probably a function of that, but I do find it genuinely disconcerting, and I'm not talking about sort of the violent imagery. I'm actually talking about, you know, the development of a political philosophy where by nature sees its opponents as fundamentally evil. And I think that, I mean, I would not say that there's nothing like that on the left. But I guess, you know, one of the things is like I told you, I guess last time, I don't really listen to lefty talk radio or anything like that. I don't really pay much attention to it. I mean, obviously I read the internet, but I think a lot of this stuff that maybe you've seen, I actually don't pay that much attention to.
Yeah, it's trust me, you're not missing very much. I mean, I feel bad about it half the time because I look at this stuff and I get these quotes and I look in the transcripts of Nexus just to sort of demonstrate that people are being hypocrites about it. I mean, rather than actually listening through these programs, which I think are on all sides very, very toxic. I think that what liberals would be smart to focus on is not Michael Savage. Look, mm-hmm. case proven, Michael Savage is a sociopath. And, mm-hmm. you know, used to sell herbal remedies on the beach in San Francisco when he wasn't hanging out with Lawrence Ferlinghetti. The guy is nuts. Mm-hmm. We know. Focus instead, I would say, on the stuff that comes from politicians. I mean, look, you know, Michelle Bachmann saying that people should be investigated for their anti-American beliefs. I mean, that is an outrage. That is an outrage that should be a bipartisan, civil libertarian, you know, conservative left-right issue that unites people rather than, you know, Keith. Oh, I mean, there's something that is so unseemly and so just pathetically kind of circus-like to watch Keith Olbermann every night attacking Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck, and then the next night Bill O'Reilly's the worst person and Glenn Beck's the worst person. This has been going on for 4 years. We get it. You know, Rush Limbaugh's a jackass. You know, people listen to him. It's unfortunate that he has a big audience. But, you know, why not focus on things that are, I think, that matter more, which is when politicians say that, you know, we should, you know, write a bill that prevents handguns from being around members of Congress, or we should ban symbols that look like targets. I mean, and this is the stuff that we should be focusing on rather than what, you know, Michael Savage is saying. I mean, goodness, yeah, by all means.
Well, he's become so obscure. I mean, like his stock has fallen considerably since Beck came into town.
I mean, the last thing I heard about Michael Savage was, strangely enough, in The New Yorker.
Yeah, that's the last time I heard anything about it.
So, anyway, we're running up on an hour here, and if anyone is still listening,
it's time to go.
This amazing.
Another disappointingly cordial episode of Blogging Heads. However,
I can end it on this, Adam Serwer. I hate you.
I
just don't like you. You're not a nice person, and I just decided that now. And maybe we could cut that and put it at the beginning of the Blogging Heads just to deceive people. So
sure.
But another interesting conversation, and I hope we have another one soon.
Absolutely, great.
All right, Adam.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks.